You're listening to the My SBA Loan Pro podcast, hosted by Ryan Smith, principal broker and founder of Think SBA, a one-of-a-kind loan brokerage serving small business owners and entrepreneurs in their quest to purchase real estate, acquire a business or franchise, or obtain working capital. In each episode, Ryan reveals valuable insights and best practices regarding the SBA loan program and application process. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Smith, principal and founder of Think SBA, and welcome to another episode of the My SBA Loan Pro podcast, Face to Face. I have with me today Brian Geisbauer. Brian is a tenant representative and commercial real estate broker with Kidder Matthews. He has been with them for 9+ years, and he's been in this space for over 20 years. Brian, welcome to the podcast, and please tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to this place.
Thanks, Ryan. I appreciate you having me on. It's quite an honor to be part of this, and hope we do you justice and give your audience kind of what they're looking for. How did I get here? I mean, it's a long, crazy story, but it's been almost 25 years now. I'll be starting my 25th year in real estate brokerage this year. And I've been with some of the largest commercial real estate companies in the world, and I've been with small boutiques. And so far, the 10 years at Kidder Matthews has been a blessing.
Awesome. And Brian, what I'd like to do right now would pretend that I'm a small business owner, and I need office space. And I need someone to represent me in negotiations with a landlord. The first thing I'd like you to do is tell the audience why they should work with someone like you, obviously the value that you bring to the transaction, and then identify those particular areas where business owners can get in trouble with a lease if they don't use you, and then obviously how you help them overcome those challenges and difficulties.
Sure, Ryan. So I think it's important to know, or important for, you know, any business out there to understand, is landlords lease space day in, day out. It's their core business, primary business. They're well advised, and it's how they make money. Conversely, tenants are not in the real estate business, at least most of them aren't. And they carry out this process every 3, 5, 7 years, right? So it's not their core business. It's not how they make money, but it's really important for tenants to look at this process as a way to remove liability, create flexibility, and really focus on their business. For most businesses, real estate is going to be the second largest expense on their P&L. So understanding the process, making sure you're looking at it very holistically is important. So they're not really overloading their balance sheet on unnecessary expenses.
And you brought up a good point. I'd like to just settle in on this for a few moments. Landlords are in the real estate business.
Right. Shocking.
A business owner is, they might be in the financial planning business. They might be in the legal business. They might be in the medical business. They are not in the real estate business. And so I love when Brian shares his pitch, because he reminds everybody that the landlord is an expert in what you and the landlord are about to negotiate. And 99% of the time, the tenant is not an expert in real estate. So I just wanted to emphasize that for the audience.
Boy, I'd love to take you to more meetings with me, Ryan. You really set that out there and tee it up. But you're right. I mean, if you're not doing this every day, if you're not living this every day, it's hard for anybody to really go toe-to-toe with the landlord, because the entire process is tilted towards the landlord. They do this every day. They have all the data. Every major brokerage house is feeding every major landlord data because they want their business. They want to take their listings. They want to service them on every aspect, because that's how they make money, right? So if you're a business owner going into this process, if it's the first time or the 15th time, having somebody on your side to help navigate those waters, it couldn't be more important. right? Because these things, while a lot of it doesn't change, a lot of it does change. It changes by existing market conditions, what's going on in the debt and equity and capital world. All of that impacts the way the landlord makes decisions. And if you don't have somebody advising you every step of the way, how do you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Do landlords expect for someone like you, Brian, to be on the other side? And if someone like you is not on the other side, do these landlords look, you know, kind of lick their chops like they're looking at their prey as they go after a potential tenant who doesn't have representation?
Well, a tenant that's not represented in the market is certainly telegraphing that they're not as astute as some of their business counterparts out there looking at space, for sure. I mean, I wouldn't say the landlords are licking their chops, but they certainly feel like they've got the upper hand when they've got a tenant that's not represented. I won't say uneducated, because that's not necessarily fair, but not represented, sure. And it's not that I'm a better negotiator than my clients. I mean, I've done work for major law firms, and I assure you they're probably better negotiators than I am. But what I bring to the table is a buffer, right? It allows me to negotiate a little bit in a black box. You share certain information, you don't share other information. And it's not designed to mislead. It's just designed to create a buffer so that, you know, landlords are forced to compete, right? I mean, it's just like going out to find debt. You want the banks to compete, right? You want B of A and Wells and Chase and all the big lenders to compete for that business and sharpen their pencil. Same thing on my side. I mean, we want landlords to really sharpen their pencil and make sure that, you know, they're being as aggressive as they can, putting the right concessions forward so that, you know, my client has the best set of data at their fingertips to make the right decision for their business. Again, most of these businesses do this every 5 to 7 years now, right? So if you make the bad mistake today, you're living with that for a while.
And talk about that bad mistake. What are some examples of mistakes that business owners make when negotiating these leases?
Oh, wow. I mean, it could be a lot of things. I mean, the one thing I see most is tenants don't fully address and understand their growth patterns, right? You know, I've done a lot of work with early stage companies before and venture funded firms. And, you know, they look at this cash inflow so they can go make decisions. But sometimes they over anticipate their growth, and sometimes they under anticipate their growth. And that's why it's important to have some flexibility in these leases. You know, business is anything but static. Unfortunately, lease decisions are static, at least to the large part. So, you know, we really focus on getting our clients to kind of begin with the end in mind, understand how they're going to utilize their space starting day one and what that might look in year three and in year five. And look for ways to create some flexibility in the lease, whether that's through options to expand, rights of first refusal, termination options, so they can get out of things if things go wrong.
If an individual business owner is negotiating with a landlord without you, is a landlord going to share those things with them? Or are they just going to, hey, if the business owner doesn't bring it up, we're not going to bring it up?
Probably the latter. I mean, there's no reason for them to bring up concessions on the tenant side unless somebody else brings it up for them. I mean, again, this is how they make money, right? A lot of these lease negotiations is really a education for the tenant or the business owner as much as of anything else, because, you know, if they don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, if I'm a business owner looking at the lease contract, can you just identify some sections that I should be aware of and how you make sure that I'm protected in those sections?
Sure. So, I mean, to begin with, I want to stress that I'm not an attorney, so I can't really provide legal advice. So anything I say here is just really more related to business terms and not the legal aspect of the document. I always want my clients to bring legal into this transaction so that, you know, they're covered on those fronts. But, you know, a lot of things, there's a lot of different sections within a lease that can get tenants in trouble. Certainly it's operating expenses is the biggest one. Understanding how landlords pass on increased expenses to tenants over the term of the lease is extremely important. And if you don't fully understand that, I mean, there's a lot of gotchas in there. And there's many things that you can't really change. Many landlords aren't going to change their operating expense structure to satisfy one tenant. But if you're a big enough one tenant, I mean, you can certainly get them to bend a little bit more. So, but more than anything, just understanding how it works is really important. As you get into some other things, option language, understanding what constitutes notice in a lease. I mean, having options in a lease is wonderful. It gives you control over the space. But I think a lot of tenants don't really look at the option for what it is. It's a defensive move more than anything. It's not offensive. And if you're looking at your option as an offensive move, you're probably already behind the eight ball. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean,
Brian. What does that mean, offensive, defensive? Explain the difference there for someone like me who doesn't understand that.
No problem. So Ryan, imagine you've got a lease, right? And you have an option to extend. That option to extend is going to contain some language in it that's going to require you to provide notice to the landlord of your intent to want to renew that lease. And a lot of that language requires the notice period to be between, on average, 9 to 12 months, right? So 12 months out from lease expiration, you have the right to come to the landlord and say, "Yo, Mr. Landlord, I've got this option. I want to exercise it." And that lease is going to have different ways in which the landlord and the tenant will arrive at what market rates are. At least if it was negotiated well, it should. Sometimes it just continues at an annual increase of CPI or 3% or 4% or whatever was negotiated in the lease. But the important piece is if you're a tenant of any size, and I'd say of any size, maybe 7,500 square feet to 10,000 square feet or more, you should really be looking at that lease renewal at least 18 months prior to make sure that you're looking at all of your market options and all of the different scenarios that are available to you as a tenant. And if you're waiting till the 9-month or 12-month mark, you've probably missed the opportunity to renegotiate prior to that option. So I advise my clients that, hey, we want options. We want options in our lease to provide us with comfort that as we're investing money into our facility, whether it's an office facility, whether it's a manufacturing facility, that we want to have control over the space. Because if we're making investment, we want to be able to amortize that out as long as possible, right? And if you don't have those options, you're kind of stuck, right? Because you've made this investment. Now the landlord knows you're captive. So they have really no reason to want to negotiate with you. But by having the option, looking at this thing in advance, that option now becomes defensive. If you can't negotiate what you want to negotiate, as an advanced renewal option, right? Advanced negotiations. Then you always have the backstop of, I'll just negotiate the option and take the worst case market scenario, right? If there's no other options out there. But by looking at it far in advance, we have the ability to have some more flexibility. So that's what I talk about. That's what I mean in terms of offensive versus defensive.
Got it. Okay. No, I really appreciate you clarifying that. And then you had mentioned a TI allowance. Can you talk about landlords? What does that typically look like? And what is that allowance for?
Okay. So the TI allowance, TI kind of stands for tenant improvement allowance. And in most leases, landlords provide a allowance for a tenant to go in and rehab the space. It's very rare that one tenant will utilize the space the same way as the next tenant, right? So if you've got one operator or one business that's, let's say, a financial services firm, and then you've got a tech firm coming in on the backside, those two tenants aren't going to use the space the same way. And improvements need to happen. So landlords, as part of the overall rent structure, provide for an allowance for the tenant to go in and make alterations to the space. So that's what that TI allowance is for. So whether they need to demo some offices, create some offices, change the lighting schematic so that they get more light for open areas or less light for, say, a studio like this, right? That's what all those TI dollars go for.
And is this safe to say that a tenant improvement allowance is ultimately amortized in the lease cost over the years of the lease? The landlord's not losing money, right? I mean, they're not giving people, oh, here's $300,000, go do what you want to do.
Oh no.
They're gonna recuperate that somehow, right?
They're gonna recuperate that with interest.
With interest. Okay. So
with interest.
So that's very important for business owners to understand, is that essentially the tenant improvement landlord allowance is the landlord saying, I will give you this money to make these improvements. However, I am going to essentially loan it to you without loaning it to you, because they're going to get paid back the principal of that. And then you said, which I never thought about, but they're actually going to get paid that back with interest over the life of the lease. Is that correct?
That is correct. Every landlord's a little bit different, right? I mean, you deal with a small mom and pop local landlord. I mean, their cost of borrowing is going to be at one level. And if you're dealing with a large institutional REIT, their cost of money is going to be a different level. But ultimately, everything in the lease comes back to the tenant, right? Operating expenses, maintenance, management, commissions, all go really back into the structure of the rent the tenant is paying. You know, I often have clients come to me and say, well, you know, I'm not sure we're going to use a broker to renew or use an advisor to renew. You know, we've got a good relationship with the landlord and, you know, they'll give us a break because they don't have to pay a commission. It's such a huge fallacy. I mean, the landlord has got a broker of their own. They've got a listing agreement, and what is being paid or compensated to the brokerage community is outlined in that agreement to begin with. So just because landlord decides not to use anybody or tenant decides not to use anybody, landlord's still paying the commission. Their broker is just taking the entire fee versus splitting it with your representative.
So essentially, you are an invisible cost on the settlement statement, and you're going to save them, right? To potentially save them money and negotiate a better deal for them.
If I'm worth my salt, I'm gonna save them over the life of the lease 5 times what my commission costs in that overall transaction.
So you make pennies off of their dollars.
You betcha.
That's what I always say to people. I make pennies off your dollars.
Right. You betcha. I'm a rounding error.
That's right. And so just to make sure everyone understands what you said, the landlord has a relationship and contract with the listing broker. That listing broker is the one representing them and their entire legal team to negotiate this with the small business owner. And when you're inserted, your commission or your payment for services isn't from the small business owner. It is from that broker who is contractually aligned with the landlord, correct?
That's correct.
Again, that's fantastic. So, and I heard you say that before and other tenant representatives say that. They get to represent the small business owner, negotiate on their behalf because it's your business, just like the landlord, right? Your business is real estate. You're not in medical. You're not in financial advice. You're not in legal, just like you said, right? You get up every single day and you focus on real estate. And so that's something that obviously we should emphasize here.
Yeah, I think it's fair.
So Brian, I've been your client now for 5 years. And I've grown. And because of you, I can now look to buy a building. And so I call you, hey, Brian, thank you for representing me in this lease. Like we spoke about in the very beginning, I've grown to the point where I'm ready to buy. What is the first step?
Well, the first step, and then this might sound counterintuitive, but I always ask my clients, why? Why are you looking to make the transition from tenant to owner? And I'm sure you asked the same question, right, Ryan? It's they're essentially taking up capital and tying it up in an illiquid way, right? It reduces their ability to do other things. So I always want to understand the motivation there, because I mean, if you're not careful with your cash, you can put other pressures on the business that might not necessarily have ever had to be, right? So understanding that, I think, is really important, because I hate getting the phone call, hey, thanks so much for helping me buy this. You know, we love it, but we can't afford it anymore, and we need to get our cash out. And when you need to get your cash out of any investment, usually that means you're going to be taking it at a loss, right? Because you've got to move it quickly. So I always want to make sure my clients fully are prepared for what they're going into, right? Because again, you're tying up liquid with illiquid, right? So that's my first thing. The second is really understanding what their growth model is going forward. Have they kind of reached the precipice of where they wanted to be at this point in time? I mean, we talked a little bit earlier that leases are not very flexible, right? They're pretty static. Well, a purchase is even more so static, right? You go into it, you're looking at at least you should be looking at this over a 10, 15 year hold horizon, because that's when the difference between lease and buy really starts to separate. So understanding that piece is important, you know. And then it's, hey, let's go build the team, right? It's a little bit different than a lease process. I think when you're looking to buy something, you want to assemble your team all at the front, right? You want to have your architect on board, because ultimately you're going to be using space differently as a user or as an owner user than you are as a tenant. And you're going to make that investment a little bit differently. So how are you going to use your space today versus tomorrow? Having your legal team put together to review the purchase and sale agreement and the LOIs is really important on the front end of this as well. And of course, more than anything, hey, let's start talking about banking, right? They need to sit down and talk to Ryan Smith and make sure that they're looking at all the possible loans. Because some of the things you've put in front of my clients before, Ryan, are shocking. They're so aggressive. They're shocking. We had the opportunity to work together not too long ago with one of my clients. It was a financial services firm, right? And they were tenants forever, and wanted to get into the into a building that they could own and grow into and operate for the rest of their business cycle. And I remember we were sitting there on the phone talking about their different loan options, and they were talking to all the big guys, right? They were talking to B of A, and they were talking to Wells, and they were talking to Chase. And they threw out a number from one of those groups, and it just seemed high. And because you and I had a conversation just casually maybe 2 weeks before about the same financial institution, and you said, yeah, this group was quoting me, you know, at the time was it, you know, 6.5 or whatever it was, right? And these guys were sitting telling me they had like 6.85. I'm like, that doesn't seem right. I said, listen, I know you guys have these relationships with your banks, but I think you need to go talk to Ryan. Just for nothing else, but right, just to check the box.
Yeah, sometimes I validate. Sometimes that's all I do.
Right, 100%. Well, I mean, I think you know the user I'm talking about, right? I mean, you came in and introduced a different vehicle for them through a different lender and blew their socks off, right? But had we not gone through that process to start and knew what all of our options were, both on the real estate side, the financing side, they never would have known what that option was. I mean, ultimately, they ended up moving forward with you. They closed on the building. Sooner than they might have been able to close otherwise, because not only did you bring the best money, but you brought a lender that was creative as well as far as the loan and the improvement funds and everything. It was a huge success because they took the time up front. And one thing I stress, whether you're leasing or buying, is if you're not spending the time up front to do the work, nothing is going to end up the way you want. I mean, it may, but it's not going to be as you kind of envisioned from the start.
By accident. It might, by accident.
Right. Ultimately, there's going to be a compromise, I guess, is mm-hmm. where I'm going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where you can design it. So I love what you said there. Put your deal team together, create a plan, and then execute that plan. And so, Brian, once a business owner has decided they're going to buy, they have a war chest to inject into the property, they've assembled their deal team. What do you and the business owner do next?
Well, now it's back to the process. It's identifying all the different options in the market. And we do the same thing on the lease side. I mean, the process isn't that different, lease versus buy on a transaction, right? We can go to the market, identify the pool of options. What do those look like? Can they accommodate short-term, medium-term, long-term objectives? Go to the market, tour those options, create a short list, figure out how you fit in each one of them. Maybe you've got an architect on board now already. Let's test fit them. How are you going to fit into it, right? Let's not buy something that you can't fit into. Let's not lease something you can't fit into. Make sure that you can use the space for what you want to use it for. Now, I recently had a client that was looking at a building up in Orange County, and they had a interesting component to it. They wanted both office and some warehouse. And the industrial market is pretty tough these days. And based on their use, their warehouse needs weren't huge. So we were looking at some office buildings that were priced pretty aggressively to go in and possibly retrofit and build out a portion for warehouse. But as we got into it and dug in a little bit more, the cost to make that transition just didn't make a whole lot of sense. But we were looking at creative ways where we could accommodate their objective. But before we did that legwork, they never would have known whether or not it would work or not. So understanding how you fit into something on the front end is going to save you a tremendous amount of dollars on the back end, right? So once we figure that out, you go ahead and you make an offer, negotiate, you know, multiple offers on those fronts. And, you know, ultimately you're going to pick a horse. You're going to choose the one that best suits your needs. You're going to go to purchase and sale agreement or a lease where your legal team's going to help advise and make sure that the document reflects what you need. And then you go through your due diligence process and close.
And what does the due diligence process look like on a purchase, and how is it different from a lease?
So let's talk about the purchase side first. You're going to bring in a team of advisors to think of it like you're taking your car to the shop. You want to lift the hood, you want to look underneath and make sure all of the mechanical work right. Right? So when you're looking to buy a building, it's the same thing. You want to bring in a inspector who's going to look at every aspect of the business or every aspect of the building. Sorry. They want to look at the HVAC. You want to look at all the electrical. You want to look at all the drainage and sewage. You want to look at the roof. Make sure that there are no glaring issues that are going to impact you once you get in. For the lease, a little bit different. You know, so you're going into a lease to a building that's maintained a lot differently. You don't own the building. You just want to make sure it's maintained well. You want to understand the operating expense structure, who's responsible for what maintenance. So it's a little bit different on that front. But some of the due diligence we're doing these days related to leases is really understanding the landlord and what their structure is. I mean, everybody who's watching CNBC or Fox Business these days hears all these stories about the office market and office buildings and, you know, how many are underwater. Well, it's funny, as much as landlords are looking at tenants and wanting to understand what their capital structure is and are they credit worthy, I mean, tenants should be looking the same thing at landlords right now, especially office landlords. You know, understanding where they are in their debt cycle, it's pretty important, right? I mean, if they're close to having to refinance their debt and they can't refinance their debt and it goes back to a lender and you happen to have a favorable lease, I mean, you could be at risk. So understanding that aspect is pretty important as well.
That's a good point. I'd like to talk about the purchase agreement in a purchase. And if you could talk about the life cycle of the purchase agreement from the buy side and what the buyer needs to, first of all, be aware of. So there are different timelines, correct? And then if those timelines aren't met, how does that impact you as the broker in negotiating with the other side?
Okay. So I think what you're getting to, Ryan, is the structure, the kind of the structure of the deal, right? You know, so the buyer signs a contract. What happens next? Is that where we're going?
Yeah. What happens next? How fast does it have to happen? And if it doesn't happen that fast, you know, in the way I see it is with a real estate broker such as yourself, that's really the most difficult part of your job, I think, is going back to the listing broker and the seller and negotiating more time.
It certainly gets sticky. So let's start from the beginning. So typically you sign a lease, you've got 3 to 5 business days to get your earnest money into escrow, open escrow, and start the process. Escrow is going to kick out a document with a timeline. And basically they're going to say, okay, you've got 30 days from today to satisfy your physical review and inspection of the building, and that what we'll call the contingency period, right? So that's the time in which the buyer brings in all their specialists and advisors looking at the building and making sure that all of the building systems are functional and as they expect them to be given the age and location and type of building that you're looking at. Now, running concurrently with that is typically a financing contingency, which will run 45 days. So the physical contingency expires 30, but you still got 15 left for the financing piece, which, you know, their banker or broker is running feverishly trying to get all those items lined up. You know, that's the point in time in which, you know, decisions have to be made. Hopefully by that 45-day period, the buyer has a commitment from a lender, right? The lender is ready to move forward. They've got the appraisal taken care of, and hopefully the appraisal matches or exceeds the purchase price agreed to in the PSA. And hopefully at that point in time, everybody's ready to remove contingencies and move forward to close. And that's typically when the lender now has another 30 days, 45 days to close, right? I mean, that would be ideal. Some can go faster and that's great. Some need more time, but that's kind of what you're looking at. So, you know, we're looking at a 30-day look, 45-day financing contingency, 60 days to close. That's kind of the typical model that I see. Obviously those things are negotiable, can change, but that I would call that the typical kind of schedule.
The typical schedule. And if one of those timelines is going to be missed, so you mentioned due diligence, financing, and then obviously the closing date or the end of the contract. If one of those dates is going to be missed, what do listing brokers or commercial real estate brokers who are representing the seller, what do they typically look for in a concession? And let's just say this is an amicable arrangement. The buyer's moving toward closing. The seller is really motivated to close. They don't have a backup offer. They're not looking over the buyer's shoulder to someone else. So everyone is working toward an amicable close. What would typically be a concession that the seller and their broker would ask a buyer for in order to extend one of those or one of those contingency dates or the closing date?
Most often those can be satisfied with the buyer depositing more earnest money into the escrow account. Usually though, once you get to that point, you know, assuming for a second that everything's amicable and everybody feels like things are going well, the question is whether that money going into escrow is going to be hard money, where it's immediately gets transferred to the seller, or whether or not that is a refundable, as you know, your typical earnest deposit is up until contingencies expire. So that's the biggest question. So it kind of really depends on the timeline, but if the buyer is willing to deposit more dollars into escrow and they're confident with where they are in the process, usually those hurdles are easily overcome. It's when the buyer isn't fully committed that things get tricky.
And there's a lot of trust involved, right? There's trust from the seller because the property is off the market during due diligence. And there's a lot of trust from the buyer that they're not, they being the seller, isn't hoping they miss. Or, you know, I had one instance where the seller actually was the one that broke the contract, but they did it in a way that was subtle. And ultimately the seller walked away, they got sued, they lost. But there's a lot of trust in that buying and selling and buying contract, isn't there?
There is. I mean, but that's why it's really important to have a really tight contract. I mean, because as a seller, once you enter escrow, I mean, the buyer's got all the interest in the property, or the buyer is in control. And that buyer, if they have 45 or 60 days, I mean, they can really put the seller in an awkward spot if they can't perform. So it's important for the seller to understand that the buyer has the ability to perform when they get into these contracts, right? Because they don't want to tie up their building for 60 days, have it come back to the market and have to explain why it didn't sell, right? So there is a lot of trust. And I mean, having two seasoned professionals on either side of that transaction that can communicate openly without divulging confidential information is really important.
Got it. And as we begin to wind this down, the first thing I want to get your advice on for the business owners that are watching this is in regard to a new phenomenon. So if you don't have your head in the sand, you understand that the residential market is a little bit bumpy right now. And what I'm seeing is residential brokers, and again, residential brokers who are experienced in trading residential properties for people to live in, are now more willing and are experiencing where they are picking up commercial transactions. And so let's say I'm your client, Brian, and I have a real estate broker on the residential side who's a good friend of mine, and he or she calls me and says, "Hey, Ryan, I heard that you're looking to buy a commercial building for your business." "Yes, I am. Thank you so much." "Hey, you know what? I'm a licensed broker in the state of California. I can represent you on that." Brian, why is that an absolutely terrible idea?
Well, are you going to walk into brain surgery with a heart surgeon?
No, I love that. Absolutely right? Not, right? No.
I mean, they're both surgeons. They both can, you know, provide medical services, but they're different animals, right? Completely. I mean, it's funny you say that, because I don't see it very often on the flip side. I don't see many of my colleagues decide they're going to go list their buddy's, you know, $2.5 million house on the Bluffs in Carlsbad or in Pacific Palisades, right? And if you ask me to take a listing on the house, I go, "What?" Like, I wouldn't even know the first thing to start. And that's just not my model. So you know, everybody is good at something, right? That residential broker, while licensed in the state of California to conduct business, absolutely. But you hire the right person for the right job. It's like, even if somebody came to me and said, "Brian, I own this commercial condo and I want to sell it," I don't take listings. I don't take listings ever. I don't represent landlords ever. It's not what I do. I represent business owners. I don't have a conflict of interest. I don't take listings. I'm here for you and you only. I'm here to help my clients get better results in real estate transactions, because their core business isn't real estate. Now, they can certainly go hire that residential guy, and can that residential guy or gal execute on that business? Probably. Will it be a successful outcome? Depends how you measure success. Would I do it? No, I wouldn't. I just don't think it makes sense.
They're going to miss a lot, right? They're going to miss a lot, right? I mean, they're going to miss a lot of what makes commercial unique as opposed to residential.
They will, because mm-hmm. they don't do it every day. Mm-hmm. You might, at that point, you might as well just go represent yourself. I mean, honestly, you might as well.
Less hubris involved, at least, right? Less hubris if you're just representing yourself.
Right. And if you feel bad for your buddy because his business is down and or her business is down and you want to throw him a bone, then write him a check. Because it's going to cost you, it costs you less to do that than what it will cost you as a result of their efforts.
So really quickly, small business owner, if you are right now looking to buy a building for your business and you have a residential broker approach you, contact you, no thanks, I'm good. Go seek out someone like Brian. And if you're in Southern California, I would say seek out Brian. Brian, I want to transition now toward the second part of the closing. And that is for you to continue along the case study you started in regard to the financial services business you and I worked on. So just to tee it up for the audience, they were an existing client of Brian's on the lease side. As he said, they leased for a long period of time. And then they finally decided that they wanted to buy. Brian, take us through that case study from how they were introduced to you, how you're able to secure a lease for them, and then transition them to buying and owning their own building and the thought process behind that for them as business owners.
Sure. So, I mean, I had worked with these, one of the partners in the financial services firm, he and I used to network quite a bit in a couple of different groups. So we had known each other socially and professionally before they were ever clients. And as we kind of got to know each other really well over several years, he called me one day and said, listen, Brian, my lease that we've been in for the last 5 years is about to expire. You know, when we bought this business from the previous owner, we inherited their lease. And, you know, we don't know if this is where we want to be long-term or not. We've always talked about possibly buying a building for our business at some point. I don't think we're ready for that yet, but we need some help with this renewal. So I said, yeah, absolutely happy to help. Let's send me a copy of your lease and all the amendments and documents. Let me take a look at it and kind of see how it compares to current market conditions and whatnot. So I spent some time reviewing the document and analyzed the lease and came back to these guys. And we had some open dialogue about the existing business, where it was going, what their plans were. And they were certainly in growth mode, but they really didn't want to take on a bigger lease. So we were able to work with an architect that we knew and run some different test fits on their existing facility. What can we do to move some walls around, open up some space for more of a workstation environment because they work in teams. They didn't need these huge offices for their business. So that's kind of the path we started down. And as we looked at the cost of putting the doing all the construction work versus relocating, it made more sense to do the work underfoot and then, you know, extend the lease rather than relocate. So that that isn't always the case. Usually, when you're talking about a major renovation underfoot, the distraction of that and business disruption of the construction happening while you're in the space is too hard for a lot of people to get their arms around, right? These guys, you know, they embrace technology, so it was easy for them to do that. So that's kind of where the genesis of all of that started in the relationship. And as we, you know, fast forward another 5 years, the lease is coming due and we're about 18 months out and we start having this conversation again. And one of the partners says, you know, we really, really want to buy something. And where they were, their business operated, they didn't have a lot of small business or small building opportunities. You know, there's some markets like the Irvine Spectrum have all kinds of small office buildings. North County, San Diego has a lot of small office building options. These guys were more South County, south of the 56 and in San Diego, and there's just not a lot of those options. But we did identify a condo, and it kind of checked a lot of boxes. And we brought in an architect. We did some test fitting. And before we knew it, we were offering to buy. We tried to get the existing landlord to renew them. The landlord couldn't get out of their own way. It was what was seemingly a simple renewal. They just couldn't get their minds around. So ultimately, they lost their client because they couldn't respond to a proposal. So we found them. We found the space for them to buy. They, we went through the process. We found a loan. We found an architect that came in and redesigned everything for them. They brought a contractor on board, and it all went really, really smoothly.
That's great. And what I heard you say there, Brian, is you were introduced to them because you were out in the community, which you are. Number two, they recognized that you're an expert, so they contacted you. Then the third thing is, and this is something that is not talked about often or enough, in my opinion, when you're working with a trusted advisor, because they trusted you, you were able to take all of the burden of finding a space, finding an architect, financing, all of that. You were able to take that off their plate so they could focus on their business. And so you could focus on your business, and you were able to represent them, take them through the entire process. And now they successfully have purchased their real estate. They are happy. And now, you know, happily ever after, as they say. So that was a great case study from beginning to end of how you really take the burden off of the business owner when they're, again, working on a lease or a purchase. And so, Brian, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You've provided a lot of great information for the audience. And if you will, just close us out by telling people how they can get in contact with you.
Sure, Ryan. Again, thanks for having me today. It's been an honor. Wasn't too sure where this was going to go, what the conversation was going to look like. I imagine you get that a lot. So hopefully the information I shared, somebody gets some value out of. If you want to have some additional conversation with me, find me on LinkedIn. Certainly probably one of the easiest ways, Kidder.com. You can find me in this in the Carlsbad office. And prior to Kidder, I worked across the country representing one user in probably 15 markets. So I understand markets, just not just San Diego or Southern California. I'm familiar with doing business across the country.
Well, I know Brian's an expert in this, and any small business owner looking to buy office or flex or light industrial would be well served by being represented by Brian. So Brian,
thanks,
have
Brian.
A great rest of your day. And I'll see you soon.
Sounds good. You too.
Thank you for listening to the My SBA Loan Pro podcast. Be sure to like, share, subscribe, and leave a review. But most importantly, we hope you'll use this information to start your SBA loan journey today by texting or calling us at 858-762-2774 or completing our online application at mysba.pro/app. That's mysba.pro/app. We look forward to working with you.